I'm Mort Rosenbloom, and Mary had a little lamb, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
If you wouldn't mind, you have been a journalist. You've been an author of, 8 books?
13, but who's counting?
Yeah, okay. So, and no plays, music, no plays. Songs, poems?
No, poems, don't think so. No, just, you know, I'm a reporter. I mean, I'm a reporter. That's really, if you want to put it in one word, and my books have been reporting, and my reporting has been reporting, and just about everything I do is that, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a noble enough calling for me.
Okay, so as a noble calling, when did that noble calling start within you?
You know, I was 6, I think, you know, honestly. I ran a first-grade newspaper. It wasn't a very good newspaper, but I just always wanted to do it, you know. And for some reason, I've got 2 sisters, each 4 years older than me and the other, and both of them were reporters in one way or the other. And my one sister, who's 4 years ahead of me, well, actually, both of them went to the University of Arizona Journalism School. And so I got to know the place, and I knew the professors and stuff, and thought it was a pretty, I mean, you know, it was a pretty interesting profession. And then I was editor of my high school paper, and then I got a scholarship, the Alex Parker scholarship for $125, you know, which was major money, but more than that, validation, I mean, from this wonderful old copy editor who had one of those hemorrhoid donuts and sitting around the copy desk in the Daily Star.
With his bottle of... in the
back in those days, you could have a bottle and you could smoke a cigarette and throw it into the... I mean, that was half the fun. Halfway through the night, somebody would invariably set fire to a wastebasket with their cigarette. You know, I mean, it's fucking ridiculous now. I mean, all these garbage cans all have condoms and everybody's sitting there like in a goddamn insurance office. I mean... shit, it's no fun anymore.
Yeah. So, okay. So you started with your own little newspaper here in Tucson.
And well, I was just a class paper. And then I did a little paper, but I mean, nothing serious. My first real job.
Before the first real job, I want to know, was there ever a story where you said, you know, you wrote and published your own little story either in high school or grade school that sort of you do remember?
You know, the truth is, no. Yeah. I mean, not really. I didn't write much stuff as a kid.
You had a great chance for an opportunity for a myth story.
I know. Sorry about that. Yeah. I was not a very good reporter. I just was an early reporter.
Okay. And again, was there ever a story while you were in college on the newspaper that...
Yeah, actually, a bunch of them, but it was really funny because my first day in as a sophomore in my introductory reporting class, the guy that ran the journalism school was an old New York Times, you know, he was the state editor, and he just come out and he was a really hard-bitten, cool old guy, his tie hanging open, parliament cigarette out of his mouth in class. And so we walked into the class, and he walks in. He says, "I'm Sherman Miller, and your beats are on the board." And he walks out because, you know, we all worked for the school paper, the Wildcat, at the time. I mean, that was the idea the journalism school was connected to. So everybody's looking around saying, "What's a Sherman Miller? What's a beat? What's a board?" You know, and so I walked over, and he'd given me the Campus Cops, which was the choice beat because he heard of me because of my sister and my Alex Parker scholarship. So I went over to the chief of campus police and found out that there'd been a big fraternity, a sorority party the night before, and some of the fraternity guys stole the cake or some shit. You know, so I wrote, my first story was a trail of crumbs led police to. So he really liked that. He gave it an A, and he made a big deal of it in class, and I thought, oh, this is cool, I got it made in this. And the next day I wrote another story, and he wrote an F and all the dirty words all over it, and full of red ink, saying, "He spelled the fucking name wrong," and he was really throwing his arms around about how bad it was. So I realized immediately, you know, that what journalism is about, you're supposed to get yelled at, and you're supposed to try really hard to do your best, and if you get it wrong... you got it wrong. You know, it's either right or it's not right. You know, and so that kind of started me out. And yeah, I did a bunch of stories here as, you know, local stories. My second year, I'm a junior, and this guy, Sherm Miller, walks over to my desk and he drops a piece of paper on it. And it's a letter from some guy in Caracas, Venezuela, who owns a piano store and also a newspaper called the Daily Journal. And he was writing a note around to all these journalism departments saying, have you got anybody who speaks Spanish and is stupid enough to work for the wages I don't plan to pay? So I wrote the guy a letter, and I got the job. So I said to Sherm, the professor, I'm not going to be here next year. I'm going off to be a reporter. And, I mean, he was just fearing, screaming, you know, you're going to be dead in a ditch with saliva coming out of your mouth. I've seen a million guys like you. You know, you don't finish school. You think you can do it on your own. You need a school. You need an education. You know. So I went down to Venezuela, and within 2 weeks, I was inaugurated president of the country. Because,
whoa. Do I need to back the film up here?
Yes.
Did we miss something?
Because I was working for the reporting staff for the Daily Journal, and for the first time in the history of Venezuela, they had a peaceful transition of power between an elected president and an elected president. And so this little toad-like guy named Romulo Betancourt was leaving office, and there was this big guy named Raul Leone who had just been elected. So I went to his inauguration, and very small press corps. I was right behind the new president. And so he goes out on the balcony of Miraflores Plaza with a palace with all these, you know, all the screaming population of Venezuela stretched out before him. And I get pushed out of the balcony next to him. So here's the president and me, both of us being inaugurated president of Venezuela. And I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, if you're going to shoot this dude, can you wait?
Right.
That was pretty heady stuff for a kid.
You were, what, 20?
Yeah, I was like 17 or 17, 18 or something like that. And in fact, I stayed there for a while. Then I was, then they made me editor of the western part of the country. So I was on Lake Maracaibo. I was in Maracaibo when this huge shell tanker hit this big bridge across the lake, and you know, it was a great story. I mean, the toll takers knew there was a big gap in the bridge, and they were taking what amounted to a quarter for the toll from these guys and sending them out on the bridge with a good chance they'd go over the edge. I mean, it was really, you know. And so I wrote the story. I was also the stringer for Time magazine, so I got a cable, we got cables back then, from Time magazine saying, you know, I wrote this long story, and one of the cables said, is bottom of lake muddy? And I'm thinking, Jesus, you know, editors. So I wrote back, you know, yes, bottom of lake is muddy. And I thought, you know, and a year later, there was another story about Maracaibo in Time magazine, and it said, at the bottom of muddy Lake Maracaibo. And I'm thinking, so there is some coherence.
This is how it works.
Yeah. Then I came back to Tucson, and I finished school, and I started working on the Star, the paper downtown, as a reporter and a copy editor. This guy, Sherm Miller, wouldn't give me a degree because I wouldn't take the copy editing. I couldn't take the copy editing course at night because I was being a real copy editor for the Star, and he says it's not the same thing, and of course he's right, it wasn't, but frankly I probably learned more at the Star.
No doubt.
Back then, you it's supposed to work this way now, but it doesn't. All people that work on the staff of an AP newspaper, which is about every paper in the country, they're copied, goes to the AP, and the AP can circulate it around. I mean, that was the whole idea of the news agency, is to be a cooperative. And so I was pretty assiduous at doing this because I wanted to work for him. I mean, my goal in life was to be a guy named Murray Sinclair, who was the Tucson correspondent for the Associated Press, and that to me was the height of journalistic ambition, to work for AP in southern Arizona. I mean, you know, this guy was a cool dude, and I was really, you know. And so I wanted to be hired by AP. So after about 6 months, I get a call from the bureau chief in Phoenix, who'd been seeing my stuff, saying, you want to come work for us? And I said, yeah. So I went to the editor of the paper, and he says, oh, that's really great, but you know, AP can't hire you from, I mean, they worked it out. They couldn't hire me from a member of papers. I had to quit, so I quit my job. So then the AP guy calls me back and says, sorry, the job didn't open, but we've got an opening in Newark, New Jersey. So that was my first board assignment, New Jersey. And I went to Sherman Miller, the guy at the University of Arizona. I said, is this a good idea? He says, absolutely, because then you're near New York, you can bug him on the weekends. So I went to New Jersey, worked for them for a while, bugged him on the weekends in New York. And
what year?
This is 1965.
Okay.
Okay, so, and I'm in working in Newark in 1965, bugging him in New York, and there's this little war starting in Vietnam. So one day I get a call, you know, and I'm like 14 at the time. I'm, you know, 21 or 2 or some shit. I'm young. And I get a call from New York saying, you know, the general manager wants this to go. So I got transferred to New York to work on the World Desk. And one day I get a note in my box saying the general manager wants to see you. So I was working all night, you know, the overnight shift. And so I hurried home, got on a shave, got on a tie, came back, go see him. And, you know, we go through about like an hour. We're going through, you know, Vietnam this, and you got to do this, and then we'll need this, and don't forget to get, you have to get your leech boots, your combat boots with little netting in them so the leeches don't even get in and bite your feet and all this shit. And I'm thinking, and the last question, I'm walking out the door, and he says, oh, by the way, what are you going to do with your apartment? So I was sharing an apartment with another AP guy named Barry Kramer. And the guy says, wait a minute, you're not going to Vietnam, Kramer is. And I picked up, he was a huge guy, and I picked up, and I was not a huge guy, and I picked up his desk, and my knuckles were white, and, you know, and we were on the 7th floor, and I think he saw himself going back through the window. He says, you're going to Africa. And I have no idea if he was thinking about that when I first come in the room. But in 1967, in August, you know, I was based in New York, and I was gone up to Boston to see my sister. And phone rang, and it's New York, and they say, okay, you've got 4 hours to pack and get to Kennedy, get to LaGuardia, fly down to Washington, get a visa for the Congo, and go take up your position as bureau chief in the Congo. And this was in the middle of a mercenary war. I mean, right. It was a huge, ugly mercenary war back then. And our guy who was there had been thrown out for the fourth time, and they needed somebody, and I was ready to go anyway. So I left for a 45-year career as a foreign correspondent with about 2 hours' notice and carry-on.
And your first war, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so I hopped on. I mean, I made it, and I flew down to LaGuardia, raced into the Congo embassy, got a stamp, raced out to Dulles, flew to Brussels, got a quick briefing in Brussels, which was the control bureau for the Congo because it's a former Belgian colony, hopped on a Sabena flight, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, here I am scared shitless.
Yeah.
You know, with all my, you know, well, not all my stuff, I didn't have that much stuff. But I had acquired a suitcase full of stuff, and the suitcase is disappearing off, you know, in some direction, and I'm, you know, it's this man. And started this career. So, I mean, I told them that I can speak French, and of course, that was a slight exaggeration, you know. Like I wrote in this little book, I said, and my sister was joking, she says, you know, you're going to have to say the guy is killed because you don't know the word for wounded, you know. So I went running around, and I managed to get a pretty good story the first day. And then I went to the telex booth, which is, you know, back then we used telex, this big clunking, hulking machine, you know, in this tiny little room that just stank. And here was this Secret Service guy in a reeking black shirt, you know, he totally drunk on Primo's beer, weaving like crazy and dandling this FN submachine gun like it was a baby. And I'm punching away, and he drops it on the floor, and the magazine bursts open, and shells are spinning, and he's jumping in the shells, and I'm looking at, I'm typing, and it's total gibberish. You know, I've never seen one of these machines before, and I think, what have I fucking got myself into? And but it was great, because A, everything after that was up, and B, I was able, by just pure chance, to do what any foreign correspondent or really anybody should do on the first day, which is impress the shit out of your bosses, because anything you do for the next 50 years doesn't matter. You know, they bring you to the first day.
How long did you stay in the Congo?
I stayed in the Congo for 2 years. And then there was a really ugly war, civil war in Nigeria, the Biafran War. And so I got transferred to Lagos as the West Africa correspondent. And I spent a year there.
I'm assuming there were some life-threatening times in those periods.
Oh, yeah, there were a few life-threatening times, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you can't be a journalist anymore without those things, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, you get guns shoved up your nose, you get drunk guys at roadblocks, you get pushed in the cells, you get, in Lagos... you know, the Congo, you don't know what's going to be life-threatening. But in Nigeria, you know, you get near any war front, especially the old kind, well, any war front, you know, shit flies around and explodes, and you got to kind of watch it.
You have been a professor of this subject. So you have this green but very competent young man or woman who's about to go off on their first foreign correspondent in a war zone. Mm-hmm. What's the one piece of advice you give to him that has nothing to do with journalism but has to do with survival?
Listen to the penny drop. Just be really aware. Hone your street smart and stick with somebody who knows what the hell they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's all about hearing and sensing what might be dangerous without really knowing what it is. And you have to develop that. You know, some people never get it, and some people who have it get whacked anyway. You know, you can't obsess about this sort of thing. You know, you never do. I'm a total coward. I hate to be in danger. I really do. I hate it when people stick guns up my nose. You know, you got to decide. I mean, if you're gonna do this job, you got to do whatever is required. Because if not, somebody behind you should be doing it. So what I tell kids always is, you know, find the person who you admire and you know, who you've seen happen, you know, you've seen figure this out, and stick with him or her, often it's a her, until you get it yourself.
You rose from the battlefields of the Congo and Nigeria to editor of the International Herald Tribune, right?
Well, I don't know how much rosing there was. I mean, I just did my work, and I was lucky in that. Well, actually, it was a funny incident because this Biafra war was going on, and I mean, I got to say, I don't, you know, I mean, there was a photographer named Greg Marinovich who I was talking to him once. I said, "Oh, we really got lucky," and he says, "Luck is being in the place where luck happens," you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you really have to kind of. And so when I was based in Lagos, I was, you know, I would, every midnight, I'd tune in Radio Biafra and, you know, listen to the newscast, you know. And one day I heard this guy, this breakaway guy, say, "I have left the country in search of peace," and blah, blah, blah. And I think, oh, fuck, it's all over. And so I went racing down to the cable office. I had a telex by then. But I went racing down to the cable office because I didn't want to trust the line, you know, and I spread money liberally around the room and made a bunch of friends, you know, people I already knew. So I was there in the cable office with my shortwave radio listening all night until there was the follow-up broadcast. At midnight it said the commander-in-chief will have an important announcement, stay tuned, that's what it was. So I went down to the cable office and I waited like 3 o'clock in the morning. He comes on the air and he says, "I have left in search of peace." I mean, it's all over. So I filed this bulletin and I got, you know, like 600 words off which back then was a lot.
Yeah.
And then on the telex, you know, you have to have, you're talking to somebody, you know, it's like, you know, and you say, you know, is it, you know, did you get it? You know, if you, you type, you know, RCED, you know, received, and they type okay, you know, bye bye. And, you know, in fact, we'd had an exchange about who's coming where, and, you know, I mean, we actually had a conversation, and we were pretty much done with everything, and the power went off. The power went off all across Lagos.
Oh.
I mean, just, you know, it used to happen all the time. And the power was off for 4 hours. So 4 hours later, when the power came back on, the Reuters guy, the UPI guy, everybody else had a stack of cables this high saying, right. You know, where's your story? Associated Press saying it says the war's over. So I had this huge beat.
Right.
By
timing is everything.
Total luck, you know. I mean, and, you know, and being in where luck happens. So I was pretty high in AP's list. And so they said, where do you want to go? And I said, we got Singapore open, Kuala Lumpur. And I said, absolutely. And
transitioning from writing column inches to writing words per page and working in the world of books. Mm. What, your first book was, what, 90?
You know, yeah, let me 80? Think. I can't remember. It was 79. My first book was Coups and Earthquakes. I mean, first big book, real book. So I wrote it while I was at the trip. So that would have been between 79. It was published in 1980, I think.
Yeah. And you've gone on to publish.
Yeah, I've got about 13. I was writing my third or fourth book. I don't know, a book on France called Mission to Civilize. And it was the first book, you know, the computers had come in. So there was this big Apple IIG, the big stand-up machine.
Yeah.
This board. And I'm typing away on this computer, you know, a guy had come to the house and installed it. And, you know, and it was like, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm a real pioneer here using this machine. And I'm thinking, God, this is like, this is fabulous. And I'm punching away. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, no. Oh, fuck. This is horrible. I mean, now everybody can write. I mean, infinite number of monkeys and infinite number of keyboards, you know.
Infinite number of garbage.
And it's like, and it took, you know, some years, but, you know, back then when I was writing books, you know, there were 50,000 books a year published in America. And you had to sell it to somebody, and it had to run this gamut of different people who had to think it was worth putting money and time into. You know, I mean, people would read it, and they'd say, no, this is dog shit, and they'd pass it back to you, and you'd either rewrite it again or you'd do another project. And, you know, and then your agent had to sell it to somebody, and they had to give you an advance, and, you know, and it was just, you know, it was a real complex project. But it was always worth doing, and you knew that when you did it, something would happen to it, there'd be publicity, and there would be this and that and that. That's sort of changed, if you want to leap forward.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is it's really great that anybody can publish their own books, because a lot of people should be able to have access to this, because a lot of really good books wouldn't otherwise be published. But today, there's like 500,000 books published each year in the United States alone, not counting, you know, things like blurbs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a friend of mine who's wanted to write this book about, and I'm advising him not to. You know, he's writing a book about all the candidates, and, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, for one thing, by the time it's a book, the election's going to be over.
Yeah.
But, you know, by the time you finish typing, half the candidates going to be gone. But 3 days later, I get an announcement that he's published the book. You know, I mean, he, you know, went to Amazon, blurbed it on the, you know, on their site, and all of a sudden it's an ebook. You know.
And print on demand.
And I'm thinking, you know, no, just call it a book. I mean, I just know too many people that, you know, it's not, you haven't earned the B. You know, I mean, it takes a long time to write a book, and you got to think about a book, and it just, you know, there's an organic connection. I mean, I can't think about a Kindle. I mean, I think, you know, it is true, it's a useful device, and I mean, there are reasons for it, and, you know, I respect technology, I like it, but, you know, I hold a book, whether it's somebody else's or my own, and it's a product of something, starting with what starts up here, and starting with all the work that goes into it, and you know, the editing, as much as you want to kill editors sometimes.
And art directors and publicists.
The whole thing. I forget the publicist part. But from the time, I mean, there's something about first sitting down to do it and the time that first book comes out of the cardboard box, usually in a FedEx package for me. Something about that, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, it's you have to think about it. You're saying to somebody, okay, I want you to sit down and commit, you know, if you're a fast reader, a day's time, if you're like me, 3 weeks' time, to what I got to tell you. And I'm not telling you because I got this huge ego. I mean, some of us do, but I mean, some people really earn it. But anyway, never mind. But it doesn't matter, you know, what one thinks of oneself. I mean, the point is, if you're going to take somebody's time and tell somebody that you've got something to say, you better have something to say. You know, and you better think about what it is, and it ought to be worth reading, and it ought to be put together in the words that you think. It should be in your voice, and it should be in... But it always requires an editor, it requires bouncing off, it requires packaging, it requires... And the fact that it can be faster, that's good, but...
But now you've also taken and launched Dispatches, yeah. Pardon me.
Dispatches, when we started Dispatches, it was only in print. I mean, we had a website, but it was only to you know, promote it and backstop it and show stuff like that. I mean, the idea of Dispatches was a quarterly. And I started with a photographer named Gary Knight, a very good photographer. He's the guy that started Seven Photo Agency, and an amazing, he's very strong, very good reporter. Reporter, but a photographer. And we had a third person, a guy with a bunch of money and a vision. And our vision was that we believed that if we produced quality in a quarterly, close to the news, that really explained stories and really told you what you needed to know about stories and made you know the characters and the background and come alive with really good art, people would pay for it. So we got, I mean, you know, my first, I had Paul Theroux, I had Samantha Power, I had John Lee Anderson, I had the best people there are. And Gary got the best photographers there are. I mean, Gary would think about, you know, there's no photographer in the world that Gary can't call up and say, we want to use your work. And so, I mean, we had Yuri Kazarov, we did a thing on Iran, we had Yuri Kazarov doing the photos. We had, it was like 70 pages of Yuri's pictures that Time magazine wouldn't touch. Because they were too graphic or too strong. And, I mean, you know, original things that he did. And I had Rod Nordland write a piece. It was an amazing, I mean, I must say modestly, publication, a quarterly. Cost $25. And it sank like a stone because people who will spend $25 on a gin and tonic without even thinking about it are not going to spend $25 on, you know, a piece of art. It was beautiful. I didn't design it, so I can say it was beautiful, beautiful publication. You know, you put it up on your shelf and something happens in Iraq, 2 years later you pull it off the shelf and you see some really... I mean, our Iraq story by Rod Nordland was entitled It Only Gets Worse. And, you know, it was right about the time everybody was talking about the surge and everything like that. And, I mean, you know, it wasn't... But see, it wasn't proper. He covered it from the 80s. He knew Saddam from the old. It was reporting. You know, he wasn't guessing. It was reporting. He saw it over and over and over again. It only gets worse. Anybody that's been a reporter in the Middle East that understands this first thing about Iraq knows that, you know, you go in on your own, and that's, you know, in under your own flag, you're going to push Humpty Dumpty off the wall, you're going to create this huge fucking mess, and you better have a dustpan and friends. You know, and that's what happened. We broke Iraq, we owned it, and, you know, everybody says, oh, well, we won. Look, it's a democracy. Yeah, you know, and bring back those million dead people that, you know, shouldn't have been dead, and bring back the 4 million people that are bouncing around the world now trying to remake their lives, and, you know, and the fact that there's now a Shia majority next to a Shia country that we're trying to push around with our little tiny fingers. I mean, go figure.
As a journalist who's lived beneath the bell all this time, when you turn to writing books, do Do you force yourself through in the same way?
No, you've got to learn it. It's very hard. My first editor was very good. She was very tough. And you know, I thought, oh, 100,000-word book, it's easy. It's like 100,000-word pieces, you know?
Yeah.
It's not. It isn't. And you really have to learn how to pace and topic paragraphs and, you know, and chapters and completed thoughts and things. And
when you were growing up, was there anyone who encouraged you to write, any books that you read that were like your favorite that made you want to write?
You know, I don't think so. I never really thought about writing. Yeah, I kind of always wanted to write a book, but it just, to me, it seemed like so impossible a pursuit that it just didn't even occur to me. You know, I mean, I read books, but I mean, as a kid, I read the Hardy Boys and the silly shit, but I was never like, I mean, like, you've asked this question to Paul Theroux. Paul grew up with, you know, reading books, and I mean, his whole life was books, and that was kind of his escape because, you know, he just didn't really fit in Medford and stuff, but not me, no. I mean, I was eating Mexican food and riding my motorcycle through the desert and having a pretty good time, and, you know, I wasn't very bookish. It was more the curiosity of people that, you know, and it was only later that I kind of thought about books. I remember I tried to write my first book in 68 in the Congo. I was going to write a book about the Congo, but I had no idea what I was doing, and it was not a very good book, and I didn't get very far. And then I got busy recording, and I didn't get back to it until much later.
Do you encourage people to think, or do you support their thinking that there is a future and a livability in writing?
You know, the funniest thing is that it's never been, I mean, with all the newspapers cutting back and all the, there's never been a better time for a young reporter to really get out there in the world and start reporting. Because everybody's pulling back and they're not sending out staff people, there's still a need. And so, the bad part of that is, you know, all these people that just want to go out and do it my way, which is to have fun, and, you know, it's the wrong way. You know? Fortunately, I had a boss that kind of whipped me into shape and wouldn't pay me unless I did it the right way. But yeah, there is a future. But I really worry now about, you know, I mean, you have to know things. I mean, it's not, I mean, the citizen journalist, I mean, you know, go find a citizen surgeon to take out your appendix. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like I want to sort of mystify the profession, but, you know, the worst a bad doctor can do is kill one person. You know, a bad journalist can start a war.
Yeah.
I think I've been really, really lucky to, I mean, I really caught the absolute best possible time to be a reporter. I mean, I kind of came in right when, before Vietnam, when people were starting to notice the world and the world was starting to notice them. And I went through a long period where there were a lot of people on the story. It was like 12 and we all knew each other, you know. And I went through a time when editors actually believed and trusted their reporters. I went through a time when if you wrote something, there was a chance it would be in a paper and somebody would read it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was really lucky. I mean, I expense accounts. I mean, I got to see, you know, I've covered, been to maybe 200 countries, you know, if you count territories and places that are no longer with us. You know, I've been everywhere. Someone else's money, you know, and I feel like I've earned a lot of it. And so that's great. I mean, looking back, I mean, I just got to thank who's ever up there that I had that opportunity. What I worry about, and that's why I spend so much time teaching, and that's really what's so much more important to me right now. I mean, the French call it transmission. Us old guys have really got to pass on the craft to people who care. The problem is, I'm not really sure how many of them do. Some definitely do. I've got a really good class right now.
Yeah.
I just was working on a big project with a young woman from Spain who's came through Columbia, you know, and got is a graduate from Columbia, did a really good, I mean, she's a really good journalist in terms of tracking down data and a real bulldog and stuff. But we were talking and I'm saying, you know, we're talking about the New York Times, you know, I mean, how nobody will pay for news anymore. And she says, well, I wouldn't pay for the New York Times. I mean, why should I pay when I can get it free? I mean, I don't need to pay somebody to tell me Gaddafi's dead. And I'm saying, like, you of all people, you know? I mean, you know, you could also fill your gas tank for free. You know, take your garden hose, shove it in your gas tank, and your needle will read full. Try to go somewhere.
Mort, we're at the end of the tape.
Good. One of the things I can say anyway.
So much for this.